Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, October 26, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the drone papers, what they are, what they aren't. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from our single expert today of about 10 to 15 minutes, maybe a little bit longer than that, but that's about the range. But as always, we'll be turning them to you for questions, so please be thinking of those questions. We're very pleased to welcome Adam Klein. He's a visiting fellow at the Center for a New American Security. His complete bio has been provided to you in the notice of today's call, so just once again, brief with our introductions here on Teleform. Let's get right to the program. With that, Mr. Klein, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thank you to FedSoc for inviting me and to all of you who have called in today. I'll start with some basic background facts about these documents, just so we're all on the same page, and then I'll briefly discuss my thoughts about the so-called drone papers. I'm not going to get too deep into the weeds. Instead, I'll just highlight what I think are the most interesting issues that these disclosures raise for the drone debate to set the table for your comments and for our discussion for the rest of the hour. So to start with the basics, the drone papers refers to a cache of leaked U.S. government documents that were recently published by an online news site called The Intercept. If you're not familiar with The Intercept, it's run by Glenn Greenwald, the journalist most famous for midwifing the Edward Snowden leaks. I think I can fairly say, without being tendentious, and my goal here is not to pick on The Intercept. I do have a different outlook than they do, but that's not the purpose of my speech today. I think I can fairly say that they're known for being skeptical of the intelligence community, skeptical of U.S. national security policy. You might even say hostile, but that probably won't surprise you given Glenn Greenwald's leading role in the Snowden disclosures. With that said, 10 days ago, The Intercept went live with a major series of articles that they called the Drone Papers. Now, the backbone of this series is four leaked DOD documents. Three of them were classified at the secret level, and one was classified at the top secret level. Now, in practice, there are really only three documents. One of them is a shorter version of another, so for convenience, I'll just refer to the three documents. But the first thing to note here, based on the small number of documents, is that this isn't a massive archive on the scale of the Snowden revelations. So the first what do these documents contain? The first document is a slide deck talking about DOD drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia, with two case studies discussing specific strikes. The reporters at The Intercept were able to identify the target of one of those strikes by matching public reporting with the operational details in that document, in that DOD document. The second document is a review of lethal operations in a region of Afghanistan, Nuristan province. And that document also includes a case study of the killing of a specific Taliban commander. So there's some fairly specific information in these things. The third document is a single slide. It's quite interesting, though. It appears to be a watch list of SIM card geolocation data for cell phones used for targeting these strikes. And to their credit, and this is a responsible move on their part, The Intercept appears to have redacted the names or other personally identifying information on this slide. So The Intercept, based on these three documents, there are four, but in reality there are only three original documents, they published eight articles based on these documents. So that gives you some sense of the proportion of just actual concrete disclosure to reporting that they were making out of it. So with that out of the way, I'll offer a few of my own thoughts to spark the discussion here. For me, I think the most important big picture thing to take away from this incident isn't specific to drones at all. Instead, it's that the national security bureaucracy is still leaking, and I don't think this is going to end anytime soon. The Intercept has an entire article discussing setting the stage and giving the leakers motivations for revealing these documents. They describe the leaker as a source within the intelligence community. So that's all the specifics that we have. We don't know whether it's male or female. But I think it's telling that the source describes in the article his or her own motives in terms that directly echo Edward Snowden. I'm going to quote the reporter's paraphrase here. I quote, "The source believes the public has a right to understand the process by which people are placed on kill lists and ultimately assassinated on orders from the highest echelons of the U.S. government. So set aside for a second the description of this as assassination, which I think I personally think that's wrong, and I'll get to that later. What I think is interesting is, like Daniel Ellsberg and like Snowden, the source views this as being about the public's right to know. Now, of course, the leaker is the one who unilaterally decides that that right exists. And I think this is quite unfortunate. The American people determined through their elected representatives that with respect to these pieces of information, public safety and the need for secrecy trump the public's curiosity. Yet again, however, we have seen one person with a thumb drive that is unilaterally capable of reversing that public judgment. But that said, whether we like it or not, we can see that the Snowden model is going to be a continuing irritant, a periodic irritant for our national security agencies and for our foreign relations for years to come. And our agency should be thinking about how to live with it until our cybersecurity becomes so impenetrable that people can't get these documents out anymore. I wouldn't hold my breath. Now, a few thoughts about the substance of the drone papers. First, a general point. From the tone of The Intercept's reporting accompanying these leaks, you would think that they discovered a massive archive containing thousands of damaging admissions about the program. But if you look at the documents themselves don't actually back up the conclusions that they're drawing from them. To give you just one example, in the documents, the operators of the drones over Yemen and Somalia complain that they don't have perfect intelligence, they don't have a constant unblinking stare, as they call it, at the targets. The Intercept takes that complaint that we don't have optimal, ideal, omniscient intelligence, and they say that targeted killings, quote, depend on unreliable intelligence. So I think that's an example of the drawing unwarranted conclusions that aren't really backed up by the documents, and there are others. Now, the documents do tell us a fair amount. They do give us a fair amount of new, previously unreported information about the process of targeting. And for lawyers, I think that's an especially salient part of this story. Now, the interesting thing is that what these documents do tell us about the process of targeting should actually be reassuring if you're worried that drone strikes are being used too precipitously or with inadequate oversight. Now, one important caveat here, this refers only to targeted strikes in Yemen and Somalia, what they call the AUMF strikes, not in Afghanistan, which is an active war zone and has a different, less restrictive targeting process. Now, here are some key facts from the DoD slide deck on Yemen and Somalia, a few specifics. First, the approval time. How long does it take to get approval for a proposed operation? The average time for the political and military chain of command to approve a proposed strike was 79 days. Now, if you drop the single longest approval, which seems to be an unrepresentative outlier, the average is still 58 days. That's almost 2 months to approve a strike against a high-value target. And this isn't a rank-and-file soldier about whom we have little information. These are high-value targets about whom massive intelligence dossiers have been developed. The fastest approval was 27 days. So clearly we're not launching these strikes on a hair trigger. There's a long wait for a lengthy chain of overseers to approve each one based on the intelligence dossier that the analysts have prepared. Now the slides also tell us about those dossiers that on average 6 years of intelligence gathering preceded each operation that was eventually launched. Now a few words on the chain of command that I mentioned earlier. The slide decks give us some interesting new confirmation about this, that the president approves every strike carried out in Yemen and Somalia under the 2001 AUMF. And as you'd expect, it's not just the president. The president is only the capstone of a long chain of approvals from the combatant commander, the joint staff, the secretary of defense, the principals committee, the heads of the national security agencies, and only then does it get up to the president. And this process, according to these documents, at least the portrait that they give us, is not a rubber stamp. We learned that of the proposed operations covered by this internal review in this slide deck, 1/6 were rejected. So that shows that there is meaningful oversight taking place here. The overall sense that you get, I think, if you were to read these slide decks, is that the operators who are carrying out these strikes in Yemen and Somalia view this lengthy process as a constraint that is slowing them down. Now, that might be how you'd like it to work if you're concerned about insufficient accountability and insufficient political oversight in this process. On the other hand, if you're more worried about getting terrorists off the battlefield as soon as possible, you might think that taking 2 months to consider proposed operations is too slow. And remember, 2 months is just the average, so many took longer. Now, I mentioned earlier that one document in the deck does raise some serious questions. That document is a slide deck assessing the effectiveness of a series of kinetic strikes in Nuristan province. I mentioned this earlier. This series of strikes they call Operation Haymaker. The review, and this is according to this document, the Department of Defense hasn't confirmed any of this. The review covered 56 kinetic strikes in Nuristan province, and they, according to the document, they killed 254 people. Now, 39 of those are labeled jackpots, which we learn is the military's code for the person who was actually the intended target of the strike. The rest, 219 people, are described as EKIA, enemy killed in action. Now, we don't know who these people labeled EKIA were. The Intercept source says that EKIA is just the military's catch-all for any military-aged male killed in a strike, whether or not that person was actually confirmed to be a Taliban or Al-Qaeda fighter. And that accords with a 2012 report in the New York Times. So that practice itself might be a cause for concern, depending on how it's implemented. But I think we'd want to know more before declaring this document to be indicative of a major scandal about who those 219 people were. Were they armed Taliban and Al-Qaeda who were caught in the strikes but weren't the intended targets? If that's the case, then that would be fine. On the other hand, if they were innocent civilians who were then labeled EKIA after the fact, that would obviously be a scandal, and we should be deeply troubled about that. We just don't have enough information to evaluate these claims, and that's the problem with selective disclosures of confidential information. We don't have the context to evaluate the contents, and that's why we have government oversight bodies, the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, the Armed Services Committees, and other bodies within the executive branch. I personally don't think it's appropriate to reflexively draw an adverse inference against the government and against the operators based on the very limited pieces of information that we have. Now, one closing thought on the word assassination, something I mentioned earlier. That word, if you read the Intercept's reporting, is all over it. I personally don't think that's right, and I think it's unfair to the military officers involved in this campaign. First, as to Afghanistan, the operations there are just tactical airstrikes in an active war zone. That's utterly routine. In fact, the most unusual thing about them is how precisely targeted they are. The fact that most of the missiles are fired by unmanned aircraft is, frankly, from a legal perspective, irrelevant. The delivery mechanism is simply not material. Now, the operations in Yemen and Somalia, the so-called AUMF strikes, are more challenging because we're not engaged in active day-to-day combat there and because the targeting is so individualized. That said, let's remember that Al-Qaeda attacked us repeatedly, our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the USS Cole, and then finally 9/11. The targets of these drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia voluntarily affiliated themselves with Al-Qaeda and took up arms against the United States in that struggle. They consider themselves soldiers fighting against the United States, and Congress authorized military operations against them. So from their perspective and from our perspective, we're at war with each other, and in war, the enemy soldiers, whether they're privates or generals, are legitimate targets. The fact that these strikes are individually targeted doesn't change that. In 1943, the U.S., for example, launched an operation whose sole purpose was to kill Admiral Yamamoto of the Imperial Japanese Navy, the man who planned the Pearl Harbor attack. It worked, and our fighters shot down his plane over the South Pacific. So the question that I would ask to The Intercept is, was that an assassination? And does it depend on whether you know the target's name in advance? I personally don't think so. I think that there's a difference between attacking a legitimate military target, whether you know his name or not, and a murder that is designed to achieve a political goal. So with those issues hanging in the air, I'll stop here and leave some time for your questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is Dean Reuter. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we're waiting to see who will ring in, let me make a somewhat long announcement about our upcoming schedule this week for teleforum calls. At this point, we don't have a call scheduled tomorrow, but check our website to see if we drop one in there. On Wednesday at 2 p.m., Our teleforum will cover the situation in Iran, including Iran's assets here in the United States and elsewhere. On Thursday at 2 p.m., we'll visit with Vanita Gupta. She's the Department of Justice's top civil rights prosecutor, and she'll be speaking to us about criminal justice reform and policing. And on Friday, also at 2 p.m., 2 p.m. seems to be the hour of the day. These are all Eastern times. Friday at 2, we'll be discussing the new book, Judicial Review in an Objective Legal System, with author Tara Smith and Federalist Society founder Professor Gary Lawson. Today, of course, we're talking about the drone papers. If you have a question for our expert, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending. I've got a few questions myself, but let's take this first call.
Hi, Larry Callahan. Two questions in one, but they're actually not only one. What are the legal implications for the person who acquired the information? What are the legal implications, if any, for the persons who leak the information, considering the constitutional constraints?
Well, the legal implications are, assuming that person held a security clearance, that person committed a felony by disclosing these documents, just as Edward Snowden did, and that's why Edward Snowden hasn't returned to the United States.
But what about the newspapers that publish them? I assume there's no implications?
Well, so it's an open question whether the government might be able to charge reporters under the Espionage Act for publishing classified information. Now, for obvious reasons, that would be a very, very aggressive use of prosecutorial authority, and there are good reasons why the government wouldn't want to go there. And so I think it would be, to my knowledge, it would be unprecedented to attempt to charge a reporter for that. The Pentagon Papers case would strongly cut against that, I think. Now, but for the leaker wouldn't have any such protection, and I think the people who voluntarily accept the obligation to keep classified information secret know what they're getting into, and know that they're going to be under this obligation for their lifetime.
Then the follow-up is any effort being made by this administration to find out who the leakers are and how they went about it?
I'm sure there is.
Okay.
There hasn't been any reporting about that, but I'm sure there is.
Thank you.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll be happy to take your questions. We've got plenty of time left. Let me ask you a follow-up question, Mr. Klein, if I could. There are whistleblower protection statutes that protect employees and others who get information from the government and then disclose it. Can you say just more broadly, talk about the difference between what would be protected at the level of the leaker in terms of disclosing and what would be a felony or another crime or at least a transgression? Now, it's classified. The disclosure of classified material, I take it, is always problematic.
Yes, and everyone on this call who's ever received a security clearance knows that before your clearance becomes active, you receive a briefing explaining to you that you are under a lifetime obligation to keep secret classified information that you receive in the course of your duties.
Go ahead.
So there's no question that the leaker is fully aware that he or she has transgressed your legal obligations, and I think the use of anonymity suggests that. Sorry, go ahead, Dean.
I was just going to say, is there any mechanism by which somebody who comes into possession of classified material, who has a security clearance, who believes there's a violation of the law, is there any mechanism by which they can report that, or does that have to go up through their own chain of command, as it were?
Well, there are whistleblower statutes that provide mechanisms by which people who uncover wrongdoing can report them upward. This has been in the news of the past few days because Hillary Clinton apparently said that Edward Snowden should have used those procedures, and Snowden has responded that those weren't available to him as a contractor. But those procedures do exist, and there's no indication that this person is a contractor. To the contrary, The Intercept reported that the person was an employee of the intelligence community.
Right. Again, if you have a question in our audience for our expert, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. And again, while we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask you a question. I mean, a lot of the coverage, at least initially, on the drone papers was pretty sensational. I'm talking about beyond the Interceptor, beyond the website that initially published these. Did the press, in your estimation, did the press get this right or wrong initially? Have they made corrections? How's the press coverage of the disclosure of these documents been?
I think the press coverage, I agree with your assessment of the initial press coverage in the first days after this came out. People were calling for a congressional investigation and various other things. And to be fair, there are some aspects of this that I think the oversight committees might want to follow up on. But the fact that the coverage has died down so substantially, I think, is reflective of two things. First, that the documents themselves don't actually back up many of the more aggressive inferences that The Intercept drew from them. For example, what I mentioned earlier about the insufficient intelligence from the operator's perspectives, The Intercept extrapolated from that that the intelligence is unreliable. Now, the fact that the operators could always want more intelligence, I don't think indicates that we don't know who we're shooting at. The second reason why I think the coverage has died down since the first days after the revelations is that there are so few documents. This doesn't appear to be a Snowden-like or a Manning-like dump where there are thousands and thousands of highly sensitive documents dripping out into the public space, constantly reigniting the news cycle. So I think from the intelligence community's perspective, that's probably a very welcome difference.
Right. In terms of the age and date of these documents, you mentioned that one part of the story here is that national security is still leaking. So I take it you mean by that the Snowden documents, the documents he accessed, are now some months or if not years old, and this is a fresher leak that would indicate, I guess, after the security apparatus became aware of the Snowden leak, they made some corrections, and yet they have this leak subsequent to those corrections. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yes. Okay. Now, I think there's an important difference between the Snowden leaks and this leak. Snowden did not need the information that he accessed to do his job. Apparently, the leaker in this case, based on what The Intercept wrote about the source, was directly involved in these operations. And what that tells us is that the Snowden breach was a far graver breach than this is, because he was able to access huge volumes of hypersensitive information that had nothing to do with his day job. This person simply walked off with a few files that directly related to his or her job. So we shouldn't necessarily infer from this leak that the intelligence community has not taken any steps to remedy the excessive access that Snowden enjoyed. In fact, I would assume the opposite. I think from everything that I've heard, they are moving aggressively, and I think we can assume that they've moved quite aggressively already to patch up those deficiencies that Snowden revealed. There's no way you can prevent people from having access to information that directly affects their job.
Right. So this is a qualitatively different sort of problem. Do you know, I mean, are there problems screening individuals? I imagine there must be tens of thousands of folks who have security clearances who have access to that information they need to do their jobs.
There are millions of people who have security clearances and access to classified information. The Washington Post did a series called Top Secret America a few years ago talking about the exploding number of people with security clearances. And they include many contractors like Snowden, not just government employees. Now, people have proposed reforms to the security clearance process to reflect the evolving national security workforce in the age of Snowden and the age of digital communications. Chris Kojum, who's a former high-ranking intelligence community official, published a piece in the Wall Street Journal. It's Kojm for anyone who's interested. In the Wall Street Journal a couple months ago, proposing modernizing the security clearance screening process to get rid of the questions like, are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party, and instead to have ongoing monitoring of online activity. And I think that would be much more effective in detecting misconduct in the electronic space. On the other hand, it might be very unattractive for young, tech-savvy people, the type of people whom the intelligence community badly needs to recruit to have all of their online activity continuously monitored going forward. So it's a very difficult position that we're in, and there's not a great way to screen for it.
We've got quite a few people. Larry, you're still on. If you have a question, if you want to break in here, let me ask others. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Larry, we do have one other caller with a question, but if you have a quick point you want to make or question, go ahead.
It's a quick point. The years I had my security clearances were in the 60s, and they required a polygraph examination, which is, some of you know, is very unusual. And what was not unusual in my office was the difficulty in accessing different sets of documents. But as I think the magic word here is in this digital age, you don't have to go to a file room or a special joint action control center to pick up a document. You just get on your computer. And I think that's changed the whole process. I'd like your comment on that if you think I'm accurate.
I agree. I think the Manning leaks illustrate that very well. The fact that an Army private could download thousands of sensitive diplomatic communications and publish them. Imagine doing that in the age of paper filing cabinets. It's just inconceivable.
Yeah. Thank you.
I wonder also, this is Dean. We'll go to the next caller in a moment. Is there a tension between the targeting regime and the approval regime? I guess, you know, when you mention an average of, you know, 2 months' time, up to 79 days to get an approval for a target, that sounds to me like it's a multi-level, very complex decision-making process. And the more levels it requires, it seems to me the more diffused those documents and the classified information becomes, including with, you know, folks in the White House, on down to the guy pulling the trigger in the drone, I suppose. Is there a tension there between, is the national security community likely to want to shorten the review process, simplify it so that the documents go out to fewer people in the first place?
Now, I'm not an expert in this, but my instinct based on the leaks that we've seen thus far is that it is more likely to be a low-level disaffected employee who is the source of these leaks than a high-ranking official who has a lot to lose in the national security decision-making process. Snowden, Manning, now this person. All indications are that this person, like the previous two leakers in this chain, was a low-level official who became disaffected with his or her work. So I think that's really where the threat is.
Right. Once again, if you have a question, we've got one question pending, then our lines are open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
I understand the need to keep military decisions based within the executive political branch. But since we have a FISA court that reviews expeditiously, relatively at least, those kinds of warrant requests, would it build confidence on the part of the citizenry if there were a panel and we brought in the third branch to just review evidentiary aspects of some of the drone strike propositions?
There have been some discussions. I'm not sure if this is specifically with respect to targeting for kinetic strikes, but there were some discussions of a Guantanamo. That's a great question, by the way. For Guantanamo reform legislation, whether there should be a formalized judicial role in engaging in periodic review of the detentions, not through habeas, but through a statutory process. My instinct is that judges would be very uncomfortable authorizing secret killings of people who had not been convicted of a crime. That's not to say that such strikes are illegitimate. Obviously, in the context of war, you don't have a judicial adjudication. But I think judges would be understandably very uncomfortable doing that, and I think we might worry about polluting the judicial process by bringing it into the realm of war, where obviously the thresholds for violence and force are much lower. But I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
I think as far as a preliminary review and just the consideration as to, just in my reading on the drone controversy before this current controversy, the fact that there was concern as to how much of the decision is based in within the political structure and how oversight, we have congressional committees who were supposedly briefed on the enhanced interrogation tactics who then denied ever understanding what was being done. And so it does seem that political oversight is unreliable. And so it just seemed that if there were a basic level of judicial review of some of the evidentiary components without the final decision resting there, that may alleviate a lot of the concern.
I understand your concern that political oversight might be inadequate. I think the better answer to that is that political oversight should get better. And I do think that there are a lot of good people in the Congressional Oversight Committee working hard to make sure that these programs are functioning as advertised. That said, I can imagine there being major constitutional problems, whether even separation of powers problems with bringing the judiciary into the process of targeting strikes in wartime, which is in my mind fundamentally an executive branch function. But I understand the source of your concern.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time left to take additional questions. What are the oversight committees or subcommittees in Congress? That's one question I have. Also, the previous caller mentions, I sort of got a hint there that there might be public disapproval or controversy around the use of drones. My sense, and the last information I read is probably a year old, that the public was in broad support of the use of drones, and maybe they see it as an alternative to boots on the ground, I'm not sure. But there was an overwhelming majority of folks in the U.S. who endorsed the use of drones. Now, maybe that changes with the release of these documents, but where is public support for the use of drones, generally speaking? Do you know?
Well, I haven't seen any polls, personally. I tend to agree with you. I think the public is supportive of anything that protects us without having to make a major commitment to boots on the ground, which the public understandably wants to avoid. But I would step back and say, drones are merely a means of performing some kind of task that in many cases could be performed perhaps less effectively by a manned aircraft. So I think focusing on drones may be a mistake. I think perhaps we should be focusing on targeted kinetic strikes, regardless of the mechanism by which they're carried out, and decide whether we think that is an appropriate means of protecting U.S. national security.
So what are the various methods of targeted kinetic strikes? They include drones. They include manned aircraft. I take it. Do they include any?
Well, the reporting from the drone papers, and I can't remember whether this is in the document itself or some other source in the articles, but that 9 out of 10 of these strikes were carried out by drones in Afghanistan. I should say 9 out of 10 strikes were carried out by drones, and 1 out of 10 was carried out by manned aircraft. And there are various reasons for that. Again, this is all, much of this is non-public, so we're forced to guess. But drones can stay on target much longer. They can fly slower, so it's easier for them to keep a steady eye on the target. There are many reasons why for these type of counterterrorism, counterinsurgency strikes, a drone is an effective technical tool for the warfighter as opposed to using a manned aircraft.
I want to make another call for questions. I have one more question. But if you're in the audience, you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We're happy to take your call. You mentioned with regard to the one document on the effectiveness of Operation Haymaker that there were some 56 strikes, I think you said, 39 targets and 219 EKIAs. And the definition or the use of the term EKIA in that context is not really clear, and I guess we're waiting for more information. Will more information on that be forthcoming? Do you have any sense of, I mean, now that these documents are out there, is the security, national security sector likely to try and explain that or define it or give some context for that?
Well, there are a few things. First, the DoD has said that they're not going to comment on any of this, quite understandably. And so we can't expect any denial or confirmation of any of these details from them. And again, I think that's appropriate. They shouldn't be commenting on unauthorized disclosures. That said, some think tanks, New America Foundation, I believe, is one, have put together their own civilian casualty counts in Afghanistan. And it's possible that someone will be cross-checking those with the disclosures about Nuristan province in this slide deck and trying to figure out how many of those EKIAs were in fact civilians, if any. But I think what I'd like to underscore is just that we don't know. We don't have enough information to make a judgment. And I think that presumably the Congressional Oversight Committees and the military chain of command are going to look at this and evaluate whether it's indicative of a serious problem or whether, in fact, these were all armed Taliban fighters who were appropriately classified as enemy killed in action. But we just don't know. And I personally resist the temptation to jump to drawing an adverse inference against our military.
It looks like we've exhausted the audience here. Let me, before we adjourn the call, give you a chance to wrap up or express a final thought.
Thanks, Dean. I think this is all the object lesson of this story is not to jump to conclusions based on headlines and to read things for yourself and hold your ammunition until you've actually evaluated the claims. And I think you've seen that with this story petering out over the past week and a half, that the initial calls for major investigations of these were massive disclosures were not substantiated. And so I think that those who held their fire were wise to do so in this instance.
Well, very good. I certainly appreciate you joining us today, Mr. Klein. This has been a great call. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Then we'll be talking about the situation in Iran, including Iran's assets here in the United States and elsewhere. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.